All right, so we're going to look at two more verses. I'm taking this just a little easier here in 1 Peter. If you look at the notes, there's a question that I want to start with this evening. If you are living in a place of persecution, what do you do? And my answer would be, relocate. Get out of there. Now, the people that this letter is written to, which are primarily Jewish people in five different regions of what is modern-day Turkey, have already done that. These are probably people that came from Judea and Jerusalem, and when the persecution got too hot there, they went to where was the next logical place, some place that was far enough away from easy walking distance. So they're talking about 400 or 500 kilometers. That's not an easy walking distance for the armies or for the persecutors. But at the same place, they're also still going to find Jewish people up there that they associate with, because Jewish people are, like a lot of people, they tend to want to stick to their own. And, so they have relocated. Surely, you ask yourself, if you're under persecution, this is not God's will for your life. That's the way a lot of us would think. And yet, very clearly, as we read this letter, it's not that the Lord has lost control of the situation. And it's not like this is not a situation that they should have to go through. Fact of the matter is, it was God's will for his son Jesus to endure when he was in this world. By the way, when you think of endurance, do you think of it as a pleasant thing or a little less than pleasant? Oh, I love enduring. Yeah, you don't hear people say that all. They kind of grit their teeth. They go, I'm enduring. I'm putting up with this. I'm not giving in. If that was the Father's will for his son, and if we are in Christ, then we can kind of expect to also learn something about enduring. Now, one of the interesting things is, you know, how does God glorify himself by our enduring persecution? Does he take pleasure in watching his children suffer? I don't think so. But does he give his children the endurance and the strength and the focus and the perseverance that they need to come through endurance? Why do God's people suffer? I mean, it's just a really big question here. They do a lot of stupid things. Yeah, I mean, they also do a lot of stupid things, but true enough. But when we read here, there are enemies of God that are trying to thwart his purposes. They are trying to make sure that his people do not glorify him. They are trying to eliminate his name from the face of the earth. I still haven't forgotten when I was in Israel, and you got very crafty answers because they didn't want to lose tourists there. But if you ask the Jewish person, do you believe in Yeshua? They would answer back, yes, I believe in the name of I believe in Yeshua. And Yeshua sounds a great deal like Yeshua. You just take the A off the end or the Aleph off the end. And what they mean by Yeshua is actually a little acrostic, which basically stands for may his name perish from the earth. But they don't want to tell a Christian who might tip them that they don't want to believe in Yeshua. And if you're not listening for this, oh, hey, he believes in Messiah. No, I don't believe in Messiah at all. I've just very cleverly avoided this whole deal. But the Lord takes his people through the difficulty. Why? Because knowing how weak human beings are, and knowing how faithless human beings are, and knowing how cowardly human beings are, and knowing how they should absolutely collapse in the face of any persecution. When the Lord walks his people through persecution and gives them strength and gives them courage and gives them faith and gives them confidence and gives them comfort, what he's doing is he's basically telling his enemies, no, you might do anything you want against my people because you can't touch me, but you're going to do stuff against my people. But I'm going to demonstrate my glory by the way I walk my people through this. And despite everything you throw against them, you will not win, enemies of God. So sometimes we need to see this in a little bit of a bigger picture, like what's going on here? Anyway, if you could run and hide, where would you escape to? Yeah, I agree with you. The problem is that they would find you in Hawaii if they wanted to. The world has been opposed to Christ and his body, and that would be this church, since he was born. I mean, stop and think about what's going on here. What's the first thing that comes into Herod's mind when he hears a king has been born? And all the boys under the age of 2 in the region of that area. So, again, it's not a huge area, but there easily was a couple hundred murders of little boys. You know, there's a spiritual battle going on here. And the spiritual battle is the forces against God are trying to steal his glory, and yet God glorifies himself by what he does. God displays his grace and his power through his saved children in the face of the enemy. And the world sees and understands the gospel as it's lived out by the body of Christ. If the gospel's only words, then it doesn't mean much. But if the gospel is new life and power for living and no fear of death and total trust in God and seeing God intervene, then persecution has a whole different attachment to it. And it sees it both in the life of individual Christians and as a group. Just before we get into our two verses tonight, I just want to go through Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 to 16, just to kind of sets the context for this. Matthew 5, you should be able to know what passage that is already. Matthew 5, 6, 7, three chapters that we know as the
Beatitudes.
Yes, well, that's chapter 5, but it's the Sermon on the Mount. Now, what's significant about that? When Moses was ratifying the covenant with Israel, where did he deliver his sermon from? Mount Sinai.
Okay,
you are establishing a new covenant here. You are getting a new covenantal set of standards here. So when Jesus speaks the Sermon on the Mount, this is part of the new deal that the Lord is establishing here. But chapter 5, where are we at here? Verses 13 to 16. So this is just after all the blesseds, all those beatitudes. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has become tasteless... Now, I'm going to stop for a second. Is it possible for sodium chloride to become less salty? Right. You can leave it out. It does not become less salty with contact to the air. You can get it wet. If you dry it out, it's just as salty as it was before. The only way salt becomes less salty is if you are cheating, and rather than selling pure salt, you're mixing the salt about half with white sandy powder and salt. And in the ancient world, salt was a big ticket item. It was expensive. And that's the way they would do it. They would actually cut the salt with a white powder. And then all of a sudden you went, hey, wait a second, this isn't pure salt. This is mixed. And you're going, ugh, and I don't like eating grainy sand. And so you have this idea, you know, you are the salt of the earth. If the salt has become tasteless, if the salt has become contaminated with other things, that's the idea, how can it be made salty again? It's no longer good for anything. It's not really good for eating if it's full of sand. Except to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men, like we have here in the winter, but that's not the way they use salt there. Anyway, but what's the point here? If you're salt, you do two things. You preserve, but you also...
taste.
You also burn, to some extent. Boy, I'll tell you, when we were in the Dead Sea, where the salt content is 30%, ocean water is 3%, Dead Sea is 10 times that. They warned you, if you have any cuts or nicks or anything, you're going to know it really quick. And I had torn off my blisters off my couple of my toes, stepped in there, and just my eyeballs lit right up. Like, hey, I tell you, they healed a couple days after that, but they were pickled. It was the wildest thing. But the idea is that salt also, yeah, cleanses and burns and refines. It's quite an effective thing. Firstly, the disciples are salt. Secondly, you are the light of the world, and a city set on a hill cannot be hidden. unless you want to hide the city. Nor does anyone light a lamp and put it under a basket, but he puts it on a lampstand and it gives light to all who are in the house. In other words, what is Jesus saying here? Do not become contaminated. Do not lose your purpose because you're the light of the world. Don't hide your light. You need to be obvious about it. And then let your light shine before men in such a way that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. Here's this idea of the way we conduct ourselves in the world, and in particular, the way that we conduct ourselves in persecution and hostile scenarios is really a phenomenal way of giving glory to God, because we're not doing it in and of our own strength. We're doing it in the strength that he provides, the protection that he provides, the courage that he provides, you know, the focus that he provides. So just kind of start there. God uses his people to accomplish his purposes. And what if one of those purposes could only be accomplished by our persecution? Now, we've lived in, you know, a lot of our families have lived in North America for a long time. I'm fifth generation Canadian. My people have known very little persecution in Canada. But those days are changing. And the difficult days are coming. And 1 Peter, 2 Peter are going to become much more important letters than they've been up until this point in time for the church, because these are going to be instructional letters about how we're supposed to conduct ourselves. I just want to jump ahead to verse 20 of the chapter we're in. So we're in 1 Peter chapter 2. I'm going to read the passage, but I just want to jump to that verse 20 there. This is an interesting statement. For what credit is there, what profit is there, if when you sin and you are harshly treated, you endure it with patience? In other words, like a question I made with comment, you know, Christians do all kinds of foolish things, and as a result, they get trouble. If you have done something foolish and wrong, verse 20 of chapter 2, and then you have to endure harsh treatment, is there any credit? No, you say no. They simply got what they deserve. That's what we call consequences. Now, of course, we live in a world where we want to eliminate all consequences, but that doesn't happen. All we're doing is racking them up, and they're going to come falling down like an avalanche at some point in time. But you know what? We'll have harm reduction. Oh, that terminology just drives me a little squirrely. Anyway, but if when you do what is right and you suffer for it and you patiently endure it, this finds favor with God. God is very pleased when his children trust him enough to not run, to not hide, to not compromise themselves, to stand up and do what he expects of them. And you are suffering for doing right, and you patiently endure it. The Lord shows his favor. Interesting idea. Let's get into our passage for this evening. Two verses, chapter 2 of 1 Peter, verses 11 and 12. Beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Now, it's a short passage, but there's lots in here. If you look at page 2 of the notes here, what we've got here is Peter is instructing Christians on how to live in a hostile world. And really, this goes from verse 11 through about verse 20, verse 21. Christ becomes the example of verse 21. But we're just going to start with two verses here this evening. So verse 11, what does he say? He says, I urge you as aliens and strangers. Now, I looked at those two words, and I was just kind of smiling at what's here. Do you remember when we started this letter, I said that probably, I would say the majority of these churches would have been Jewish-backgrounded people. There certainly could have been some Gentiles in there by that point in time. But I would suggest they're probably Jewish. And in particular, it talks here about as aliens. The word there is diaspora. Have you ever heard that word? Mm-hmm.
You said it before.
Yep. What is the diaspora? It's basically a group of people that have been displaced from their land. And they're all over the place. But technically they are still a people with a homeland. But they're scattered. And we would usually say that word diaspora refers to the Jewish people. Because even before Jerusalem goes down in 586, the northern 10 tribes are gone. What's left of them has been scattered. A number of them did come into Jerusalem. It about tripled in size. Surprise, surprise. When the Assyrians came. Now you have to appreciate that when the Assyrians came or other warring countries came, they came very slowly. And you usually have like 3 or 4 years advance notice when these guys are coming. You know, okay, they made 15 kilometers this year, they'll make 15 kilometers next year, da-da-da-da. We know when they'll be here. The problem is, if you are people like this culture is, do you have liquid assets that you can say, well, you know what? I'm not going to stick around and be invaded and destroyed. I'll simply go somewhere else. Well, for the most part, their property value is in property. It's hard to pick up your land and take it away. So what could you do? Well, you could have possibly gold and silver if you had that. But if all of your neighbors can also see the Assyrians coming, what happens to property value? Down to like nothing. Do you remember what happens with the siege of Jerusalem? What's the expression? A quarter cup of dove's dung was selling for some astronomical price while the siege was on. Why? Because they were starving to death, and anything that was even remotely edible was selling for this wild price. The day after the Assyrians are destroyed by the angel of the Lord, what happens to the price of dove's dung?
Which was prophesied.
Which was exactly prophesied. Yes. But you've got this sense in which, you know, in the ancient world, even if you see them coming, how do you move your family? Where do you go to? What's interesting is when Abraham was able to buy that piece of land from the Canaanites to bury his wife, the cave of Machpelah, that is an exception. Because in that generation, in those societies, nobody ever sold land. It stayed within the family. The fact that they were willing to sell Abraham a cave, and he has a title deed, that is the, you know, he's been promised the promised land, but that's the first point of land that he actually owns. And he dies owning all of the cave of Machpelah, even though they've been promised the whole of the promised land. Remember, the Jews are not supposed to lose their land. And if you have the year of Jubilee, if you've sort of leased out your land, well, what happens? It all goes back to the original families, because the problem with invading armies is you can't move your land. And there aren't banks. And if you're on the road and you've got cash, well, then the robbers get you. So in a lot of cases, those people are just going to stand there and wait for and see what's going to happen, and they're going to be destroyed. And those who ran are the diaspora. So you had the northern 10 tribes. A bunch of them have gone down to Judea in the south, but a bunch of them haven't been able to get there, and so they're all kind of all over the place. So this is, when you use that term diaspora, you know we're talking to Jewish people, because the Gentiles go, what's a diaspora? Well, the Jews have known what diaspora is since 722 B.C., or before that, so for, you know, about 8 centuries, they've known what diaspora is. It's kind of like the word Holocaust. It's an interesting word. Do you think of Holocaust only for Jewish people, or do you think of it for other groups that have been brutally destroyed? And why? Because it's actually a word from the Old Testament. It means a whole burnt offering. And Holocaust is the Greek translation of that Hebrew word. So remember, in the Old Testament, when you did sacrifices, sometimes it was the fat portions, sometimes it was whatever, but every once in a while, the Lord called for the entire burning of a whole ox, or the entire burning of a whole sheep. And this was an ola, which gives you the olo for Holocaust. And cost is like caustic, to burn. It was like caustic chemical, still burns you. And the idea is it was a whole burnt offering. What the Jews are talking about, they're talking about that their people became an offering to the Lord and they were destroyed in entirety in Auschwitz and in Bergen-Belsen and a few of these other camps. It's just, but you think of Holocaust as Jews. You think of diaspora as Jews. It says, I urge you as aliens, as diaspora. Well, what are they always waiting for, the Jews? Well, it was, they were waiting for this till 47. Then you actually got to see who really wanted to go back to Israel and who didn't. Because you would have actually thought that after the Second World War and after the establishing of a Jewish homeland, that that thing would have been inundated with every Jew from every corner of the world. Not even close, like 5% of them went in there. But there's this sense of they are the resident aliens of the diaspora. Then the next thing says, and strangers. That is such a cool word in the Greek. It's as those who live alongside of the house. You're not inside the house. You live outside, alongside of the house. What we would call, you know, tent cities or homeless. Well, yeah. It's this sense that you do not identify with those in the house because you're different. So on one hand, you're the far-flung remnants. You're the diaspora. On the other hand, you are those, even where you live like the people living alongside the house. Kind of an interesting picture that he's painting here. You need to do this. Why do you need to do this? I'm urging you to do this. You're going, why are you urging me to live like an utter stranger, desperate to get back home, and why are you urging me to live like somebody who's homeless? Well, the point of the matter is that this is your status and your reality. Chapter 1, verse 1 of this, of 1 Peter, talked in the same way. It talked about them being the diaspora, the resident aliens. Remember that? That's how he addresses these people to begin with. Now he's telling them again, remember who you are. Yeah, if you look at 1:1, to those who reside as aliens, scattered, there's the word for diaspora, throughout, you know, way, way far from home. Here he's telling you that you need to live this way. Now, do you really want to live this way? This is a command of God. In the year 2020, having come through, you know, a couple hundred years of relative peace and tremendous prosperity for churches and for church people, I mean, we have been respected, we have been allowed to establish our families and build them up and build legacies and whatever else you want to say. All of a sudden, I'm looking at the next generation, my kids' generation, I'm going, I'm not sure that that's going to be your lot. In fact, I'm quite sure that's not going to be your lot. And whereas my parents looked at me and said, get established, get a house, get a career, build up, you know, enough money so that you can retire and you can seed your children and get them going, da-da-da-da-da, because you are fully a part of this society. Enjoy everything that the society has. Take every advantage, every benefit. Not going to be the case in the next couple generations. But then I'm hoping the Lord comes next week anyway and we're all gone. That would be good. Wouldn't have to worry about any of this. But if we are aliens and strangers, and the reality is that's what we are. Now, we haven't had to live that way for, like I said, a couple hundred years. But the times are coming back. And you can see the power of the enemy, and the Lord's allowing this, but he's getting very bold, and he is pushing hard against anything biblical, anything Christian. It's amazing, the target that's painted on everything. You would think, it says, take up arms and fight. Well, you need to fight. It's not taking up arms. You need to abstain. Abstain means to what? Just do it a little less? Abstain means to completely abstain. From what? Fleshly lusts. When you think lust, what do you automatically think? What type of sin? Sexual sin. That's part of it. But But the word here is more than just sexual sin, because fleshly means what? When you see that word, you're thinking there is the spirit and there is the flesh, and the flesh equals what?
Sin.
Yeah, sinful nature.
Yeah.
There can be definitely sexual sins, and this world is beset with sexual sin. And you think, can it get any worse? And the answer is, yeah. Anything that has to do with the promotion of self. You're going, well, wait a second. You had a chance to, you know, make something of yourself, and you had a chance to build a house, and you had a chance to raise a family, and are you telling me that I'm not supposed to have anything that's self-serving? And I'm saying that the more you get into persecution, the more that self-serving becomes a huge sellout to the other side, or you're going to get punished royally for it. One of two things here. But what he's saying here is that there's a war that's raging, and it's not the war of the physical persecutors who are attacking the church, though that seems to be a war, and it's difficult enough. But where's the war? It is the war that is being waged against the soul. You see, when we talk about being in Christ, or we talk about being born anew, or you know, conceived anew, or a new creation in Jesus, what we're talking about is that there is an aspect of new life. We've been regenerated. Those who are dead have been made alive. The problem is, and I like this phraseology, we're still incarcerated in the old body. Incarcerated meaning what?
Prisoned.
Yeah, imprisoned. Held prisoner. This is what Paul talks about so clearly in Romans 6 and 7. And he makes the case, he says, we are no longer slaves to sin. Before you're regenerate, you're simply a slave to sin. You really don't have an option. And sin is not to be our master, he says. And yet he talks in Romans chapter 7 in such painful words, where he talks about, you know, when I see the right thing that's there, I agree it's right, but I don't do it. In fact, there's a war going on that when I see that's right, that my body wants to do what's wrong. So it's not just your physical aspect, but we always talk about sin as being a fleshly thing. We have a choice. And if you look at Romans chapter 6, verses 19 to 22, it really talks about we have a choice. We no longer need to be slaves to sin. Why? Well,
slaves to righteousness.
Yeah, we've changed our master.
Yeah.
And we have the Holy Spirit living within us, so we have strength and power. And we have been given a new status because we are no longer simply those who cannot resist or fight. We actually are those who can now resist and fight. But it's not resist and fight society, though the temptation is to do that. As my friends down in the States always say, you know, they are a country that's based on rebellion, and they have a fundamental problem in that society. We, on the other hand, in Canada, are a society based on compromise. And we have another fundamental problem in our society. Canadians believe they can compromise their way to all truth and peace. Romans chapter 7, verses 14 to 25 really teaches us that there are things that wage war against our soul. And then you get that little phrase, which is kind of an interesting phrase. Be in the world, but not of the world. And you say to yourself, well, where does that phrase actually come from? And it's sort of a derived phrase that comes from a couple of truths. Let's look at 1 John chapter 2 for a second here. What does it say? It says, do not love the world nor the things in the world. Do you know how convicting that statement is? Because I love my wife and I love my kids and my grandkids, and to some extent they are things of this world. And I love places that are beautiful and are warm and we can snorkel and, you know, it's about 114 degrees in the humidity. Do not love the world or the things of the world. You understand that when he says that, what he's saying is just sort of what Jesus said. He said, if you love anyone more than you love me, then there's something wrong. You need to hate your mother and hate your father. He's not saying that literally, but he's doing a comparative there. And in this world, there are some things which the Lord has created which are very desirable and, you know, which we really love. The problem with that is that that's such a short-lived thing, and that's not the purpose that we have in this life. If anyone loves the world, here we go, the love of the Father is not in him. I don't know which letter hits harder than 1 John. It just cuts through all of the fat and all of the grizzle and gets right to the heart of the matter every single time. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, here it is again, fleshly lust, and the lust of the eyes. We are people who want to see more and more, and the more we see, the more we want to see, and the more we want to have. And the boastful pride of life. Oh, yeah, here we go. And then we want everybody to know just how special and wonderful we are. Is not from the Father, but it's from the world. And the world is passing away, and also its lusts. But the one who does the will of God lives forever. And not only do we exist forever, but when we leave this world, and all that this world has to offer, and all of the things that we think are so important and so attractive, and we step into the next world, we're going to think, what did we ever think was so special there? Because it just doesn't, and it lasts forever.
That is the reality of the way I think as well. Is,
yeah.
You know, when,
like, well, I have to remind myself of this, though.
Right. And I've said it before to my own family. I've said, you know, when Brian talks about, or Brian Van Rogge, there are some people that say, like you just did, I can't wait to be with the Lord, you know, and those kinds of things. And I always say, I can, because my heart still is here with my family, as it is with you. And I know what you're saying.
I know what you're saying. I know.
But I always say, don't misunderstand. Yep. If he took me today, I'm not going to get there and go, oh, gee, I want to go back and be gone. I want to go back, you know, to the world and go fishing. And you're not even going to care. So. I understand that aspect to it, right? But my flesh still wants to, I still want to be here.
But there's this sense in which we have to be careful, and the reality is the world is a very temporary thing. It's a vapor. And we have been given eternity. And it's not eternity with a lousy life, it's eternity with abundant life. Yeah. Infinitely more than what we've got. But we've got this reality here. And so, what is he telling you to do? Our thought when persecution comes is, let's get out of here. And I come from a religious background. If you've got a Mennonite background, you have to appreciate that you come from a group of people that have been running from places to places for the last 500 years. And they've tried to stand up for things, but it's always been difficult. There's always been the next place they could get away to. Wow. They've run out of places. You got much the same thing here, too. What does he say? He says, as aliens and strangers, the people who live between the houses, and people who really don't have any citizenship here, don't spiritually compromise by putting all of your hopes and desires in the world. This is what's waging war against your soul. But what do you do with these people who are hostile and giving you grief day by day? Well, ignore them. Go underground. Look at verse 12. It doesn't say that at all. What does verse 12 say? Keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Now here's another. When you get Gentiles, why would you write that? Who are you writing this to?
Not the Jews. Because you'd make them nuts.
But you're telling them, if you're keeping your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, another way of translating that word is among the pagans, which the Jews would go, well, yeah, all Gentiles are pagans, and among the nations. And there was always one nation that was God's nation, and then there was everybody else. The Hebrews sort of have a word for it. The Am are the people, and the Goy or the Goyim are the rest. So when he's telling them that they need to keep their behavior excellent among the Gentiles, I'm saying, you already talked about diaspora, now you're talking about Gentiles. Well, you definitely have a Jewish lens. If this is not being expressly written to Jews, and we read this letter, and we find great instruction in this letter, but just look at the lens that the Jews see the world through. And what did the Jews try to what was the attempt of the Jews? Did they want to have a lot to do with the world, or did they want to have as little as possible to do with the world?
Isolation.
Have your own country. If you have to do business with Gentiles, You don't go into their houses. You don't eat. Oh yeah, you don't eat their food. The minute you get back into sanctified territory, you wash to get rid of the old Gentile corruption. And you sort of admit that they don't even that they're less than people. That's kind of the way you look at this thing. So you can avoid them. And I think, lest we attack the Jews, I've seen lots of evangelicals do just about exactly the same thing. You know, I won't talk to a non-Christian. I won't talk to my neighbors. I won't do anything. I won't help anybody. Why? Well, they're not one of us. We're a different people. Well, yeah, we're a different people. I understand that. But look at the instruction that's given here. Keep your behavior excellent. Now, that's such an interesting word. That word means beautiful. That word means gracious. That word means attractive. That word means noble. That word means absolutely full of goodness and godliness. It really means behavior above approach. But it is, when somebody sees it, they are naturally drawn to it because it is such a pure, clean, wholesome, useful, pleasing thing. And you're saying to yourself, hey, these people are trying to make my life misery. Can't I just go underground? And the instruction is, no. The instruction here is, let them see who you are and what you do. And the things that you do for the glory of God, do it so that people can see what you're doing. Not for self-gain and not for ego and not for a photo opportunity and, you know, whatever else. But there's this idea that among the Gentiles, they need to see. And I don't think that this is in any way saying that you don't share the gospel verbally. But now I've got to come back a little bit to the nation of Israel. Was the nation of Israel supposed to be on display?
Yes.
Was the nation of Israel an evangelistic nation? What were they supposed to be? They did not go out and preach the Old Covenant. But then the rest of the nations of the world were supposed to look at them and see what?
Their God,
the nature of their God, the righteousness of their God, the compassion of their God, the care of their God, the holiness of their God, and by the way that they were to live, they were to be a light to the nations. And they prided themselves on being a light to the nations. Remember Jesus back in this Sermon on the Mount. He's setting up the new covenant. He's establishing the new constitution for his people. And what's he saying? You are to be a light. How good a light was the Jewish nation to the rest of the world? The only example that most of us can ever find is when the Queen of Sheba came to Solomon and she was amazed at his wisdom and she took back, you know, things to Sheba, which is kind of down Ethiopia way. That's about it. But this was a nation that was supposed to be a living example of the character and the nature and the person of God. Now we're talking new covenant Christians. They may be Jewish Christians. It really doesn't matter because in Christ, it's one new man. Whether you're Jew or Gentile, whether you're from any tribe or tongue, it makes no difference. But the idea here is that where the Jews had failed in living an example of godliness before the nations, what are the persecuted believers supposed to be doing here? Has God given up on this idea of living examples of his character, his nature, his compassion, his goodness? No, the whole idea here is that they are to be so godly among the nations that the nations go, hey, what's going on? What do you? Why are you different? Now, what's interesting is that don't expect that that's going to have the instant results that you hope and you're going to become a prized and respected people. We've already had that for 200 years. That's on the way out. We're in through the rearview mirror looking at that one. What does it say? So that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers. Oh, so you're going to have excellent behavior. Beautiful, attractive behavior that demonstrates living godliness. And what are the nations going to do? All the pagans? Oh, they're going to slander you. In other words, expect it. Sometimes it's better if we know what we should expect. If you have false expectations, then you have all kinds of problems. What is slander, by the way? Yeah, the difference between libel and slander is what? Libel is writing false things about other people. Slander is saying false things about other people. In this case, the word slander there means that they are going to speak evil of you. What are you doing? You are living godliness without reproach. And what are they doing? They're saying you are evil. And you're going, well, this isn't working. Because how do you overcome their wicked slander?
Jesus is a drunkard, right?
There you go. May his name perish from the earth.
Right.
If his name perishes from the earth, I tell you, something else perishes. The whole of the universe perishes. Because he sustains it all and holds it all together. Anyway, but look what it says. And in the thing which they call you evil, slander you as evildoers. That's how they've tried to translate this. It makes sense. They may, because of your good deeds. Now, do those under persecution have a responsibility to verbally speak about Jesus?
Yes.
Yes. Do you remember when Paul was under that house arrest for a couple of years in Rome? And he writes to Timothy, where he talks about that the whole Praetorian Guard has come to know the Lord. I just so laughed a few weeks ago when Larry Nelson, you know, had that fibrillation. And they thought he had a heart attack, so they loaded him into the ambulance and they're taking him in there. And as he's in there, he's talking to them about the Lord. The people that are working on him, and it's kind of, that's Larry. And then halfway to Bellingham, they have to change ambulances, and they put him on to, you know, much more skilled people, and he goes, good, it's the second group now I get to share with. And you wonder the effect that it has on people. Here's Paul, somebody's chained to him for 2 full years, because when he's under house arrest, he's probably being chained 24 hours a day to a Roman centurion, part of the Praetorian Guard. They are the elite bodyguards of Caesar. Because he's in Caesar's household awaiting this trial. Well, I'll tell you, if you've got somebody chained to your wrist for 12 hours, let me talk to you about somebody. And they're sharing your food, because the way it worked in those days is that if you were under house arrest, you provided for the house, and you provided your own food, and you provided the food for your guards. So as you're sharing your meal and you continue to talk to him, every time Paul got hooked up to a new guy, and it was 24 hours a day for 2 years, well, let's continue our conversation. Let me tell you again about who this Messiah is. We're in Isaiah now. And it's kind of going along. You see, all of a sudden, not only are they hearing it, but who are you doing these good deeds to? The ones who are persecuting you. Do you understand what Jesus is starting to say about if somebody forces you to go with him 1 mile? Here he's talking about a Roman soldier. And Roman law was that any soldier in the army could press into service any civilian, especially an occupied civilian, and say, you're going to carry my gear for me for the next mile. What does Jesus say? If he forces you to go 1, go 2. If he strikes you on 1 cheek, turn the other cheek. Still remember when I was in Northern Ireland, they were an aggressive people. Little Scotch-Irish, boy, I tell you. And they had produced a lot of boxers because these guys would not go down. They just kept punching. There was a nerve fiber left in them. They were still throwing punches. And a few of them became evangelists, which was kind of an interesting thing. And the one ran into a group of tough guys. They hated him, and they finally, were threatening him, and he kept preaching to them, and the guy smacked them on the cheek, punched him. And, the evangelist slash boxer said, "Oh, would you please hit me on this one, too?" I said, "Sure." Smacked him. He said, "Good. I've run out of instructions, and now I can do what I have to." An Irishman could tell that story, yeah. That's it. The instructions are over. But the intention is what? You treat me with malice and contempt and hostility and violence, and I will treat you with goodness and kindness and beauty and love. Eventually that diffuses something. So you have this idea, but because of your good deeds, as they have observed them, and as they have been trying to make life miserable for you, you have been loving them with the love of Christ. There is nothing more powerful in this world than loving someone with the love of Christ. MacArthur had an interesting little story about a Japanese commandant in the prisoner of war camp. And the stories I've heard about how the Japanese treated prisoners is pretty cruel. I mean, they basically starved them all to death. And it was getting near the end, and they knew that a liberation force was coming, and the Japanese were trying to get them to eat rice with the husks still on, which apparently would tear open your insides and cause you to bleed to death. But the missionary and his family actually came through this. And it was about 20 years later when they heard that the commandant of that camp had finally been captured. And he'd been working as a gardener in some other continent somewhere. But they also heard that he had become a Christian. And when they asked him what caused him to become a Christian, he said, "I was dealing with this group of missionaries, and every time I treated them horribly, they responded with love." He said, "I didn't know what to do with that." He said, "It haunted me for years to know what made those people tick, because I was trying to kill them." And it was just, wow. Like, it's just, is this what the Lord intends for us? The beauty of this is that our future is set. We're going into the presence of God. Infinitely better. Infinitely better. Where all of your desires and all of your joys will be adequately met, and then some. Which leaves the short-term problem of this life. And if the Lord in his sovereignty allows us to go through persecution, does he have a purpose for this? And this passage tells you, yes, he does. What happens here? As they observe these deeds, even though they have slandered you as evil, and they know that this is sort of this upside-down morality that we're living with nowadays. People claim to be moral, and people claim to have values, and they're virtue signaling, and it's absolutely devoid of any meaningful truth and or reality. And yet, the good deeds that you do, number one, to honor and glorify your God, because he's told you that this is favor. Remember back in this back in verse 20 of chapter 2? If you suffer for doing wrong, tough bananas. Yeah, that's what you deserve. But if you patiently endure when you've done the right thing, this gets the favor of God. You're pleasing God this way. This is a wonderful way to worship. And you're thinking, man, there must be easier ways to worship. Not in that given situation there aren't. But you've got this last little thing, that they may glorify God in the day of visitation. Everybody have visitation in your...
I've got a side note, but yes.
Mm-hmm. Visitation. Your side note says what?
Christ's coming again.
Okay. What's going to happen in the day of visitation? What does it say? You've had excellent behavior, loving behavior, but the people that you are responding to in the way that they don't expect are still slandering you as evildoers. However, they've observed your good deeds. And as they observe them, what happens? They glorify God. Is this visitation, in the day of visitation, is this a positive event or a negative event? Yeah, so the answer is, of course, yes. Sometimes that's just the answer.
Yes.
Or both. Now, in the Old Testament, you have examples of this being both a positive and a negative thing. Let's talk about a few of the visitations. Samson. Where do you know Samson from? Judges. Okay. What's happening in the time of the judges? Right in his own eyes. That, by the way, is the mantra for this generation and for the world right now. Do whatever is right in your own eyes. And as long as you're true to yourself, it's all good. This is a covenant people who are doing what's right in their own eyes. Never mind uncovenant pagans who are doing what's right in their own eyes. So the Lord raises up for Israel. They've had good... Actually, Joshua was good leadership. Moses was good leadership. The shame is, and during Joshua's time, the people did fairly well, but then there was other leaders, and they forgot about Joshua, and now they need leaders, and they're all doing what's right in their own eyes. In other words, this is sort of a... Everyone can be their own leader, which doesn't work. So the Lord raises judges. What are they supposed to do? Yeah, there's the Captain Obvious answer here. That's exact. Judge! Well, and what does a judge do? He is saying this is right, and this is wrong, and do this, don't do that. He's also delivering Israel from the hands of their enemies. Now, it's interesting. In the time of Joshua, they actually had probably enough time to fulfill the Lord's command. And what was that about Canaan? Go throughout the land of Canaan and?
Kill everyone.
So people say, we don't preach that anymore. Well, no, we're not in that situation either. There's a context that's attached to that. But the idea was they were to clean out the land because the Amorites who lived in Canaan had already had more than 400 years to repent. And it wasn't happening. So they were supposed to clean it up. They didn't clean it up. But what was the problem with not cleaning it up?
They got influenced by them.
Exactly. If you don't clean it up, you've got a negative influence in your midst, which is exactly what you've got. So you've got Samson as one of the judges. Samson's a great Sunday school story, isn't it? We've sanitized this thing and ripped it out of context. We've messed up all of the judges, I'm almost convinced. In fact, we've messed most of the heroes that we've created for Sunday school of the Old Testament. We need to revisit and look at these people a little bit more honestly. Esther ain't that hero, I'm going to tell you that right now. Samson ain't that great of a hero, unless you like your eyes gouged out and you finally kill everybody pulling them in the poles. But, you know... When I was in Israel, the thing that caught my attention at one point was the guy who was showing us, you know, where Samson would have operated. He says, we always have this picture of Samson as sort of like a cross between Arnold Schwarzenegger and the Hulk. He said, picture a 120-pound weakling. He said, because this was not on the basis of Samson's natural attributes. The Lord empowered him and strengthened him, but he was probably just the scrawniest little guy. That way you know where all the glory goes. Up to 350-pound Samson with the 28-inch, you know, biceps. How did Samson come about? Judges 13. We haven't got time to look at it, but just to remind you, Judges 13.
Yes.
An angel of the Lord comes and speaks to his father, Manoah. Yes, you're right. Yeah. And she goes to her husband. And she's going to have a son.
Yeah.
Now it says at the beginning of that passage, if I'm not mistaken, that visions and the word of the Lord was very rare in those days. It's kind of like God saying, well, if you don't really want to listen to me anyway, then why should I be speaking to you? What is Samson going to be? He's going to be a judge. For Israel, he will be a positive thing. Except when you see how stupid he is. And I say that with a measure of, you know, respect, but really, there are things where you go, give your head a shake. I have the same problem with Solomon. There's a whole bunch of anti-heroes in the Old Testament.
Yes.
My take on the Song of Solomon is that Solomon is the villain in that story.
Right.
He is the one trying to seduce the Shunammite, who is loyal to the one to whom she is betrothed, which is what Israel was supposed to be to God, and it was the nations that were seducing them. And Solomon, remember, he's the guy who has all the wisdom, but he's supposed to not do three things. Not multiply wives, not multiply horses, not multiply gold. Solomon blows them all out of the water for multiplying, you know, 700 wives and 300 concubines. And with 700 wives and 300 concubines, he's still interested in this poor little Shunammite girl. And she is staying faithful. And he's a total weasel. It's a different way of taking the Old Testament, I realize, but it's got a little bit more context attached to it. Samson becomes both a hero and an anti-hero. He eventually does defeat, the Philistines, but in the process, he doesn't lead the people on straight paths to the Lord. I mean, I love his comment, "You would have never known my weakness if you hadn't plowed with my heifer." That is just, oh man, read the statement of Samson there. But there was an angelic visit. It was a day of a visit. And on one hand, the Lord was going to deliver his wayward people. On the other hand, it was going to be judgment for the others. Samuel is another classic example. This one is a little bit more of a hero in the sense that he's a little boy, 4 years old, and he's hearing voices. Except his are legit. And the Lord is calling Samuel at four. And you're going, wow. And remember, after the third time, the Lord tells Samuel, you know, "You're going to speak for me." And then he talks about Eli, the priest that Samuel has come to live with, and about his sons. You know what really scares me about the Old Testament is so many of these famous leaders of Israel's history were the worst fathers. And Samuel's sons, and David's sons, and
even Aaron's sons.
Like, you're going, I don't know how you measure success, but to me, there's a problem in this equation here. Anyway, with Samuel, the Lord's voice, and is it a blessing or a judgment? Well, it's a blessing because the Lord is going to speak through Samuel. Is it going to be a blessing for Saul?
No.
Not so much, and he's going to anoint David. And David is this, you know, everything's good till age 50, and then you have those evil 50s, and everything falls apart. And by the time he's 70, he's so worn out and dead, and I'm hoping, I only got that, not many years to 70, and I'm hoping I'm not that worn out that I can't keep myself warm anymore. Anyway, you go into the New Testament and you've got the same thing. The Lord speaks to Zacharias. And what does Zacharias say? Well, first he's going to have a son. He's kind of got the whole Abraham-Sarah thing going there. Well, this might have worked 30, 40, 50 years ago. It's not going to happen now. Well, if you don't want to say what I'm going to say, then you can be quiet. And then you can name him. And of course, they want to name him Zacharias because it's going to be his only child. And it would be custom. And he says, no, his name is John. And then he can speak. But he has that wonderful statement in Luke chapter 6, verse 8. And he talks about the day of visitation. There's the phrase. The day of visitation is an Old Testament idea. It's a New Testament idea. Even Jesus in Luke chapter 19:44, where he is, you know, going to be crucified in a matter of a week or less, 5 days, he's weeping over Jerusalem. What does he say? If you had known what the day of your visitation meant, your king is here. I am here. You've been crying to God for 300 years for a Messiah. I'm here. And you're going to scream, crucify me? Like it's. But the sense here is they're going to glorify God. Who glorifies God? Well, you stop and you think that there's the promise made that every tongue will confess and every knee will bow that Jesus is Lord. I would suggest to you that some of them will be doing it through clenched teeth. they will have no choice. They will simply admit that Jesus is Lord and go on to their punishment. On the other hand, there will be those who think there are no more wondrous words than I could ever utter with my tongue. And with the biggest smile on my face and with my heart overflowing, I will say Jesus is Lord. I'm looking at this and I'm wondering if, and it sounds not original to me, this idea that this group of persecutors who all of a sudden are now glorifying God, did that have something to do with the way that God used his persecuted people in the midst of that persecution to work the gospel in the lives of these persecutors? Do you think Paul ever forgot Stephen?
Your heart would shake.
What did Stephen do? I mean, he echoes the words of the Lord. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. He's just preaching truth to them. He's not condemning them. They are crazy, hostile. They're killing him. But it had to have had a profound effect on Paul. Paul, in turn, becomes the persecutor of the church, who also becomes the foundation of the apostolic truth that the church will have, because everybody, in one way or another, is sort of connected to Paul. John works in Paul's plantings afterwards. Paul and Peter have, you know, their ups and downs. But Peter says, yeah, those things that Paul writes, they're kind of difficult to understand, but they're true. You know, you've got this sense in which Mark is a protege of Paul. Luke is a protege of Paul. Well, all of a sudden you've got like about 80, 90% of the New Testament. The Lord has used Paul in all of this stuff. And where did he pull Paul from? A persecutor of the church who saw the power of the gospel, which made men fearless and bold and focused, and doing anything they could to please and honor their God. And all of a sudden you've got these Gentile persecutors who are glorifying God in the day of his visitation. That could be the day of the Lord. It's another way of saying the day of the Lord is a great and terrible day, it says. Great for those who love him. It's terrible for those who hate him. But you've got, you know, both of those things, so... questions, comments? We're just starting this whole idea of what it means in terms of your relationships with others, your relationships with the world, because we go on in 1 Peter with this.